Welcome to the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. Today, this is going to be kind of like your ultimate race guide to nutrition, race nutrition specifically. So we have Alex Larson with us. We're excited to have you, Alex. How many months pregnant are you now, Alex?
I'm 28 weeks right now, 29 weeks. So I'm in the third trimester.
Wow. Alex won't be with us much longer. She's going to have a extended hiatus. Yeah.
Every month I'm on the show, I get my belly just keeps getting bigger.
Further and further away from the mic.
You said that sounds like she's dying. She'll and very soon no longer.
I'm going to become out of breath if I start talking too much. So if you hear me laboring, it's just because I have a lot of things happening here.
Having recently, somewhat recently gone through all of this, I'm just... I don't know. I'm just in awe at these women that carry on through pregnancy. And I think I would tap out at I would tap out at the first trimester. No way I'd make it past. So anyways, I'm really grateful you're here, Alex.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Yeah. I'm a little bit in denial that I'm going to have a third child here in a few months. So, but it's good. It's good. I'm excited.
Yeah, well, they definitely make training and everything, life just gets easier, I'm sure. So
much easier.
Yeah, so much easier. okay, today, like I said, we're going to cover that nutrition guide more and less. We're also going to talk about caffeine and some weird stuff that could happen with that. But before we do any of that, Ivy, you, Sarah, and I are making some content. And by the time people hear this, they will have already seen some of it. And if you haven't, then you need to head over to our Instagram or YouTube page. You need to just go to youtube.com/trainerroad or search Trainer Road on Instagram. You'll find us and subscribe, and you'll get some awesome Tour de France content. Is that right, Ivy?
Yes. Ivy cooking. Yeah. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Ivy's in the kitchen. I'm doing weird number crunching stuff. Sarah's pouring through research. It's going to be great. So stay tuned for all that Tour de France content. We're excited for it. At this point, when you hear this episode, we've already gone through quite a few stages. I think it'll be stage 7 or something like that. I could be wrong. Stage 6. So crazy times. Excited to see the tour. Let's share some. Last week we talked to one of the athletes sent in this question about how do I balance eating meals with my family at night and then also making sure that I'm feeling my workouts and train late at night. How do I just balance all of it? And I asked for suggestions and we got a handful of them, and I'm going to read through them. Alex, maybe you can point out what you like or what you dislike or any other thoughts that you have on them. The first one is from Gershon. It says, regarding Emily's question in the most recent podcast, I primarily train at night. I structure my meals during the day differently. Lunch is my biggest meal of the day. And at dinner, I eat whatever everyone else is eating, but I just eat less. After the training session, I'll drink a protein shake and eat a light carb snack. I've been doing this for years now, and it works for me and the family. So I like that one of splitting things up a little bit. Good idea. Joey says, I do all my weekday training at night. So to answer Emily's question, here is what works for me. For context, I have 2 kids, 6 years old and 2 years old. And the only feasible training time for me is at night after they've been put to bed. So that puts my training start time around 8:15 to 8:30 PM on average, which my first 8:15 to 8:30, that would be so hard for me to train at that time to start my workouts, because I just don't know when I'd sleep. I don't know about you two, but that would be really, really, really
tough. It's hard to unwind afterwards and get yourself ready to fall asleep.
Also, I'm just really tired at that time of the day. Yeah. And I don't have children, so I can't imagine working and caring for children and a family and then trying to find the energy to train. It's what do you eat? A bunch of caffeine gels, and then it's 1 in the morning.
Just don't sleep. Yeah. And it's worth stating that, yes, if you trained, if you had an ideal schedule and you could train at 10 in the morning or something like that, you would probably be able to train harder, do more, do all that stuff. But way too many athletes focus on this sort of ideal of trying to find the perfect workout, the perfect training time, when really we should all be looking at our constraints, and we should be very realistic with those, and then trying to do what we can. So this is really cool to see athletes training at times that are not this based on research, ideal time for circadian rhythm. I don't care about that stuff. I've got a life going on and I need to do something and I still want to train. So this is really cool to see. We make do with what we have, and those that can make do the best with what they have. And the best doesn't mean more or the most. The best means the right balance for what you have. That's how you're going to get the best results. So kudos, Joey, for getting it done when you do. This is totally a situation where I would take, like, if you have like ice bath or just really cold shower or something afterward, I would do that just to try to get my core temp down. Probably drink like a smoothie or something that's really cold, because that's the hardest part for me after workouts at late at night. It's like my core temp is just so high. I can't sleep with like bed sheets even, like, let alone any sort of like a comforter or anything else, because it's so warm. So yeah. Okay. Anyways, Joey says, we have dinner together as a family around 5:30 to 6 p.m., so slightly normal for here in the States. And since there is about 2 hours between this meal and when I would start training, I typically just eat whatever we're all eating. If there is a dessert, I might skip that. During my weeknight trainer rides, I typically have one bottle with 60 grams of carbs. And post-workout, I'll eat again, either another serving of whatever we had, if it's carb-rich, or a bowl of cereal or oatmeal. It's an interesting thing, right, Alex? I think that most people seem to think, like, post-workout, I need protein. And while that is true, you've probably drained a lot of carbohydrates as well. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's important. Would you say it's important?
Yeah.
Is there, like, an either or?
With Gershon's, like, the light carb snack, I was like, oh, I would maybe make that more of a moderate to heavy carb snack, depending on what your workout was, you know, if you really, like, depleted those glycogen stores, because it's not like you can really replenish them overnight while you're sleeping unless you have a good amount of carbs in your system. But yeah, I like the idea of like a cold protein shake, and whether you're adding in some fruit to that protein shake to get some extra carbs in there. I like the idea of like cereal and oatmeal just because it's easy. It's going to kind of give you that slow, steady release of carbs, you know, overnight. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm a fan of all of these in terms of like, you're making it work as a parent. And I do like your idea too of like doing an ice bath of some sort to get your body temp down too. Like that makes a lot of sense, especially in the summer months when you're already hot.
Oh yeah. And Joey kind of comments on that, says, I typically plan on being awake for at least 2 hours after finishing the workout. So the night workouts end up shifting my sleep schedule slightly. I normally sleep 10:30 to 6 a.m., but with an evening workout, that typically shifts to 11 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. It's been a great way for me to be consistent. So, I mean, looking at that right there, that's 7 hours of sleep, roughly, 6.5 to 7. So that's hard for what I've found, at least. Like, that ends up catching up with me later on down the road. I feel good usually for a week or two or 3 weeks like that, and then later on it gets tough. Parents, I know that you're listening to this and thinking
for me, I would definitely take one night a week where I was going to bed early and trying to catch up on sleep. Or like on a weekend, taking a nap like midday to just try and do some sort of catch up. Cause eventually your body's just going to be like, I'm exhausted and your workouts are going to suffer. So I would just plan on having one night where you're getting to bed at a decent hour, and I will say some people are just night owls. Like I'm more of a night owl than a morning person. I've tried to do like the early morning workouts, but I get equally as exhausted there. And especially cause my kids are up early anyways. So yeah, I'm with you. Like you got to do what works.
Yeah, exactly. Something interesting with this, Sarah looked at a systematic review recently, and this is on our Instagram page, so go check that out, also on our YouTube channel. And she looked at a systematic review that looked at late night workouts and its effect on sleep. And anecdotally, everything that I've heard from athletes and what I experienced individually, my sleep is adversely affected when I train at night. Does it take longer for me to get to sleep, but also I seem to have less recuperative sleep. That's just my observation. And then from what I've heard from other athletes, that's also quite common. But interestingly, the systematic review was looking at more data-driven measurements of that. So it was looking at like motion during sleep and then looking at REM cycles and everything else that athletes are getting deep sleep. And with all of that, it showed that as long as this is a situation where they had like 2 hours before or after between the end of the workout and sleep. And in those situations, sleep wasn't adversely affected by the numbers, right? So this is really, it's an interesting thing that I wonder if there's some sort of dissonance between perception and what can actually be measured there. I don't know. It's curious for sure. But Sarah found that and then asked people basically like, this doesn't jive with what we've heard. So but it's the research is the research. It stands on its own as the research. What does everybody think? So yeah, everyone should chime in if you're on there and let us know if you're fine training and it doesn't affect your sleep later on. And also parents, I know that when you're hearing me advocate for like 7 to 8 hours of sleep and you're waking up with like a little one or something like that, or you're a full-time caregiver and as a result, like your job just doesn't allow you to sleep, any number of different things. Please know that I'm not trying to be exclusive to you. I'm just trying to recommend like an ideal. Again, we all just do what we can with what we have. So, okay. Shay says, this is the last suggestion here that I'm going to read. We got tons of them, by the way. You can submit them at trainerroad.com/podcast with all your training questions. But I'll read Shay's. Says, I have a tip for Emily. I have 3 kids, and while I'm not a fast cyclist, I am consistent in my low volume training, and I dropped my husband on a climb earlier this spring. Please disregard his need to repair a flat tire mid-climb. Good on you, Shay. Take the dub when you can. Shay then says, I train 3 times per week at 8:30 p.m. once our kiddos are asleep. We typically eat dinner between 6:30 to 7 p.m., which means I don't have time to digest a normal dinner. Our dinners are broken into 4 parts, grains, vegetables, meat, and fruit. I eat the grains and fruit with my family at dinner time, and I save the vegetables and meat and typically enjoy a bit of alone time watching my favorite junk TV show while getting in the slower digesting but crucial parts of my dinner, the vegetables and meat, on the couch. I may or may not include a glass of red wine from time to time. Don't judge. No judgment here at all, Shay. That seems like a good approach. Alex, kind of like dividing up what you do eat. Would you prioritize the same things?
Yeah, I've told my athletes that I'm like, let's just break up your dinner into like, you know, first dinner, second dinner. The only thing is, you know, with your vegetables and meat on the couch, I would have some carbs with that too. Just again, to reload glycogen stores, hydrate, some electrolytes maybe before you drink that glass of wine would be totally acceptable on my end.
Cool. Awesome. I dig it. Great suggestions. Thanks, y'all. This is what's great. I mean, we have so many people around the world listening to this podcast. There's a lot of different suggestions that we get. Keep sending them in. It's pretty awesome. That's what makes one of the parts that makes this podcast so great. So, and speaking of that, let's get into some listener questions. Ryan says, when all the training is done and you have a race or ride coming up, what can be done in the months, weeks, days, and hours before the race? Ryan, to be clear, we could probably record for 37 hours on this part, but we'll try to be somewhat focused and succinct. What would be the best fueling plan leading up to the race, and what hydration strategies would you undertake? It's often talked about what to do during the race, but not nutrition leading up to a race. And I kind of wanted to take this as an opportunity to touch on the nutrition side, but also go into like what you do on the prep side going into an event, Ivy, on like the things that you always like your pre-race checks, whether it's equipment or anything else like that. And we can kind of step through all those different details if you're game for that, Ivy.
Yeah, for sure.
Probably first things first on the training side, they want to taper, right, Ivy? Like bring things down from what they're doing.
Yeah, well, when they're talking about specifically months prior to the race, like you're just talking about normal training preparation. It depends on how many months we're talking about, but you'll probably finish a build phase and then be in a bit of a specialty phase and then have a taper week going into your event. And there will probably be a rest week after your build phase too. So it depends upon how much, what kind of training you've been doing and how much structured training is applied before your event. That determines how long those phases will all be, including that, that build phase and your specialty phase, and your taper. But yeah, that's generally what you see leading up to an event.
Yeah. And, typically, taper, just the basics of the taper, volume reduces and then intensity remains. And typically in a specialty phase, you're getting more and more specific to the intensities that you'll experience on race day, whether that's just pure like percentage of FTP or whether it's the fact that it's like, you're preparing for a crit. And as a result, you have a lot of repeated efforts that are really close to each other, but short in duration, something like that. So it just drops down the volume, and the whole concept here is that you're still familiarized with the effort. You're still training your body neuromuscularly. And then also we're just talking about all the aerobic and anaerobic adaptations that you need to make to keep the muscles working in the way that you want them to work. But it's doing so while shedding fatigue that's probably been accumulating ever since you started training, right? And when you have that around all the time, you're not able to perform because everything is kind of doused in this blanket of fatigue. But what happens in the specialty phase is that blanket of fatigue gets lifted off, and then as a result, you can perform better. However, Ivy and I talk about this all the time. That's not going to happen if you don't follow the plan. And the time to follow the plan with most precision absolutely is the specialty phase, but it's the hardest one because you typically are feeling fit and fast. Maybe it's closer to your events and it's really easy to go out and do something that's totally not planned and maybe blow yourself up and just, despite your training plan's best efforts, layer on an even heavier blanket of fatigue on top of your ability to perform. So you'll be tapering if you're following a structured training plan, and that's kind of the training side. Can we run through equipment so then we can save the rest for nutrition really quick? Ivy, do you have any like basic, like you always check sort of stuff on equipment or like a pre-race run through thing?
I mean, yeah, if I have, I don't anymore, but if I were, well, I guess I do have like race wheels, but they're great and I train on them, often. But yeah, I wouldn't like leave your race set up until the day that you race and be surprised. Basically all these things that we're going through are things to make sure that you're not surprised by anything on your race day. That includes training and, of course, and then equipment too. So I basically want to make sure that I've ridden the equipment that I'm going to race on and that I have the setup in terms of fit, like any stem length changes or like bar angle adjustments or saddle adjustments, anything like that is done well in advance. Not trying anything new in the last, you know, days or weeks before the event if I can prevent it.
Yeah. And that's like, I've probably been exhibit A of doing that wrong over the podcast over the years. Like,
I did a UCI race last weekend on a bike I've never ridden before. So I don't follow that all the time. Like sometimes you can't, you know?
Yeah. I had a cross country marathon national championships. It was my first national championships. It was in Sun Valley, Idaho. And I went up there, had brand new wheels. They were super light and super cool. And, they also had a super razor sharp edge of resin that wasn't ground down from the factory. And it was right where the tire would press on the bead. And I didn't notice it. It was like very small. It was basically a little razor blade that would just carve into the bead until it would leak. And this was when tubeless was like pretty new. And I was like, gosh, it's not sealing. What's going on? So then like I had a tire plug and I was like, I can't even fit a tire plug into there. Why is it leaking? It didn't make sense. I put a tube in there and then it ended up slicing through the tire and slicing through the tube too. And I had a 12 and a half mile walk that I had to do on like rocky, nasty terrain all around Sun Valley, the ski resort. It was the worst. My shoes at the end, the mountain bike shoes, they were like, I mean, not brand new, but they were just like not in like completely worn. I had no tread by the end of the 12 mile walk. Like it was just like razor rocket, like chunked it all away. It was the worst experience. So had I ridden them beforehand, I would have realized something was wrong. I would have warranted the wheels and then I would have avoided that mistake. You have to like, yeah, don't walk 12 miles in the dry mountain heat. It was terrible. Oh man, it's really bad. You have to, and like some basic things that I always check before every single race. So I check my stem bolts. I check, and that's all where they mount to the bar and then also to the stem. I have a little Feedback Sports torque wrench that's just awesome. This is not sponsored by Feedback Sports. I'm just saying it's a really handy little tool that I use and I recommend it to people. It's got all the different bits that you need. So then I check a handful of things, torques, every single time. So my stem bolts, in addition to my stem bolts, my bottle cage bolts, and I know that's not one that's going to like cause me to crash, but bottle cage bolts can work themselves loose very easily. And if you aren't torquing them down, they do not need a lot of torque. Most of them, you're going to be looking at like, you know, 3 to 4 Newton meters, and that's going to be plenty to torque them down. But I torque those down to make sure, because when a bottle goes loose and then you lose your nutrition, which we'll get to nutrition in a bit, your day can be ruined. So like, don't let that happen. I check my seat bolt clamp. I check my seat rail clamp. I've had friends, go through transformational surgeries as a result of not checking that sort of thing. So, sketchy stuff. So make sure that you make sure your saddle is tight and that it doesn't break. Bad times. Carbon rail saddle did not, it turned into a sword. So, and then aside from that, then I want to go through and I want to make sure that my derailleur hanger is tight as well. And then I always check my chainring bolts. Those are like the basics. You should probably check
batteries.
Pedals too. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a whole battery strategy though that makes it so that I never have to think about it. I have a replacement battery for my derailleur and my dropper post. And then on my road bike, I have replacement batteries for each derailleur. And then when I get home from a ride, I take my batteries out, I put them on chargers, and then I have those spare ones already charged and I put them in the bike and I swap them out every ride. I'm probably degrading battery life as a result of doing this, I know, but it makes it so that I never ever have to worry about having a dead battery. I've never had one. So
what about your shifter little coin batteries though? Like you can forget about those because they last for so 100%. Long and then when they suddenly go, it's like, whoops.
Yeah, I probably change mine way too frequently, but they're usually CR2032s, at least for SRAM. And that's like the same one that your power meter probably takes, which is handy having the same thing. So I have a bunch of those and like I just swap out my shifter batteries probably once every, it's usually after every training phase. So like when I get out of the base phase, I swap over. It's like my celebration time and I go into the build phase and I know, me nice. Cutting loose, celebrating my changing batteries.
Do you have videos of you doing all this? Because I feel like that would be really helpful for me to like have a visual. Because I am not like a bike tech person and I need to be better about like checking my equipment before a race. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good point. I probably should. I also check sealant. That's another thing that I do. So it's really easy. You can use like a little dipstick and just check to see if you have wet sealant down on the bottom. And I use those Santa Cruz Reserve Fillmore valves. They are so great. I don't know if anybody, if you've used them, Ivy, but they're fantastic. And it makes it, you can remove the valve core. They're really easy. They never clog. They're awesome.
I don't know.
Yeah, they're pretty sweet. So worth checking out. But anyways, I just put in the little dipstick to make sure that I have wet sealant down there. And if it's not wet and it's dried out, I take my tire off and then I clean out anything where it has dried. And then I put in new sealant. I know most people just like dump the sealant in and that's okay too. You can do that. You know, you don't want to do this night before the race because that could incur a whole lot of stress to have to change tires. So
we have different strategies. I don't want to get the tire so off intense. The beat. Yeah. I think I just, my setup is just full of sealant. I got to have like 12 ounces of sealant there. I don't care. I just like, do not want it to run out. And I'm like, yeah, it's been a minute. I don't know. I'll just, you know, throw dump some more in there.
Yeah. 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 I mean, hey, it works. As long as there's wet sealant in there, that's all you need, right? To make sure that you don't have issues there. Yeah. And then outside of that, the drivetrain and everything else, of course, make sure that it's clean if it's not already clean, but then also make sure that it's just shifting correctly. If you're riding a mountain bike on the suspension side, nobody services their suspension frequently enough. Everyone should do it more frequently and you can take it to a shop. It's like 30 hours,
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like in some cases, depending on the suspension, it's like 20 hours, but 20 to 50 is like typically the range that you see depending on it. And most people aren't getting it serviced. It doesn't take long. You can take it to the shop and it's like a pretty quick thing to service a fork or a shock for them.
That's something I'd love to learn how to do on my own just because it's not about, it's just like the act of taking it to the shop and being away from it, you know, trying to like, and then you got to leave it there and they got to work it in. And then all of a sudden, like 4 or 5 days later, it's like, I could have been like, I wanted to be riding this whole time, you know?
That's the hard part. I think that the only hard part about suspension is just you need a lot of specialty tools. Once you have the specialty tools, then it's just like any other job. It's just adult Legos because that's what bicycles are, right? It's just like, you know, it's just easy. You don't have to like, you know, bash your knuckles like you're working on a car or something. So I'm like before single track six, which we'll talk about later, I'm definitely getting both front and rear serviced and everything else and doing all that. But like, yeah, on the equipment side, you need to check that stuff. And you should also make sure that, you know, glasses are clean or your helmet visor is clean. If you got a TT helmet, that basic sort of stuff, make sure that you got your kit laid out and all that stuff. Anyways, that's kind of like the pre sort of thing. And you do not want to do this day before. This is something that you want to start doing like in the weeks leading up to, because otherwise you're going to spend the day before doing something. You're going to get super stressed. You might even get really fatigued because you might be trying to like, you know, mount really difficult tires or who knows, like figure out some sort of complicated problem with the bike. And if you can start doing this, you know, 1 to 2 weeks out, instead of doing it the day before, your performance will be better. So, okay. So now let's talk about nutrition. And Alex, is it okay? It's probably inseparable, but like nutrition and hydration, because they're both kind of, they're important things to keep in mind.
Can you carb load for months asking for a friend, asking for Ryan.
Well, I'd break this up into like, what do you do months before the race? What do you do weeks before the race? What do you do days before the race? So with carb loading months before the race, this is where you're going to practice carb loading. And I think we've talked about this in previous episodes where if you've got a big workout or a big block of training where it's like back to back hard, long workouts, definitely do a carb load practice like the day leading up to that or even a couple days to just find out what are some of the best foods that help you hit your carb goals, what helps you feel best. It's really a lot of food. And so some people are like, oh, that didn't sit well with me. I'm like, well, let's practice a little more. Let's switch up some of the foods and figure out what's going to work best for you, making sure you're doing lower fiber, you're doing, you know, lower fat. So you're not going like way crazy in the calories, but you're still hitting those carb numbers. Like those are some things that I would do in the months before the race is just practicing that so that there's nothing new on race week. You know exactly what foods you need to grab that are going to help you hit those carb loading goals. Another thing I would do months before the race too is like learn more about your typical sweat rate in different weather conditions, doing some sweat testing. If you're someone that tends to be a really salty sweater, you know, where you have like dried, like white salt all over your body after you get done with the workout, or you tend to have some chronic cramping issues, you know, doing some sort of like specialty sweat testing that will tell you electrolyte losses. Like that type of information is really helpful to get you through your training really successfully. And then you can dial in nutrition and hydration on race day too.
Alex, that brings up a good point. Like you talked about doing it in different conditions. There's different results, right? Like if you train inside and you don't have a fan and it's like 80 degrees in your room, you're probably going to sweat a ton. Whereas if you're going up to the Alps and it's like in the spring or the fall and it's going to be cold and that's where your goal event is, then that's probably going to be pretty cold and you're not going to sweat.
If you're at elevation, you're going to be needing additional carbs. You're going to need more hydration just because like you're losing fluids just through your breath as well, like at elevation. So, you know, if you're going to be doing a race at elevation, you know, kind of figuring out what you need to do in advance and adapting like your gut tolerability to be able to do that on race day at elevation. Like those are things too that I would just plan for in advance. And a lot of athletes don't plan that months in advance. They're planning that like a week or two in advance. And like, there's not much you can do at this point because, you know, it really does take some time to like learn and tweak and adapt and figure out what's going to fit best for you. So typically I will have athletes like say, okay, what race are we doing? All right, we're so many months out. This is the rate of nutrition that we want to be at come race day. Here's where you're at right now. We need to gradually work our way up to that level. And you know, is it someone that's living down in Georgia where it's super hot right now, but they're not going to do their race until the fall up, you know, in Maryland where it might be cooler? Well, you know, yeah, let's make sure we've got hydration and electrolytes figured out so that you feel really good throughout training, but it's not going to be likely as huge of a priority for your race at the end of September.
Yeah. It's probably also worth saying like months out too, Alex, that like, this is, like you said, it's the best time to experiment because you're further away from your event. And then it's also the best time to experiment because you're probably training a lot. Like this is where you're in a build phase and you're really layering it on. And if you can learn to fuel really well now, you're just going to get more benefit from the work you're doing. So it's kind of like two birds and one stone that you get.
Yeah. There. Yeah. I use the state Georgia just because I have an athlete right now who's in Georgia. She's planning on doing a 5-hour bike ride this weekend where it's going to be 98 degrees and super humid. And I'm like, I need an alert on your watch telling you to drink. I need you to constantly take, because we did a sweat test earlier this week and she's losing over a liter of fluid an hour. I'm like, I need you on top of this or you're going to feel really poorly when you finish this bike ride. And
potentially take like blunt the next, you know, X amount of weeks of training because yes. you're just so in a hole. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, those are the types of things that, yes, this is still months out from her race, but we need to prioritize her health and like getting through this training right now so she feels really good. And that's the other thing too, like prioritizing recovery, even though that doesn't have to do specifically with her race planning. You know, you talk about those physical and physiological adaptations, really honing in on that recovery post-workout can really maximize your training and get you stronger and faster on the bike.
Yeah. Yeah. Ivy, you were, I don't know if you were going to say something. I might've spoken over you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I can probably save it till the end though. Okay. Yeah. I'll save it.
That sounds good. So Alex, that's like, you know, we're further away from it. As you get closer to it, we're talking like weeks away instead of months away. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you would suggest people change?
Yeah. So, I mean, usually in those weeks before the race, you're in like your final peak weeks of training. So you want to eat like it's your job and just keep yourself like healthy and injury free. This is kind of where people kind of freak out and be like, oh, I'm not at my goal race weight. And then they like think they need to restrict. And I'm like, nope, that's the opposite of what you need to be doing. I would start writing out your race fueling strategy, like how you're going to time things. What are you going to consume? What products are you going to use? And then make sure that you've ordered all of the fuel that you need for your race. Know how you're going to store it, carry it. Do you need to purchase anything that's going to help you carry it? I always, always plan on bringing some extra fuel with me just in case, especially on the bike ride. You don't know if you're going to drop something. I had an athlete just the other weekend. I'm up by Duluth, so we had Grandma's marathon weekend. And I had one of our athletes that did the half marathon. And she told me afterwards, she goes, you can use this for Instagram if you want, but I brought an extra gel with just in case. And I'm so glad I did because it fell in the porta potty when I went on my last call pee before the race. And so I laughed and I was like, yep, that's why you always bring extra because you just never know. And then you can always like improve your karma because there's probably always an athlete that didn't bring enough and you can always share a little and, you know, increase your karma for the day. So those are a few things like in the week before the race, weeks before the race that I would just start planning all of that. So again, you're not doing it the week of the race when you've got so many other things on your mind and you might miss something.
This is probably in terms of like macronutrient profile. Are you making any changes yet? Or does that come down to really right before the event?
With the weeks before the race, usually you're probably pretty carb heavy at this point because your training is so heavy. And something that's interesting about like taper weeks is athletes are like, oh, I'm not training as much, so I don't need to eat as much. And they'll like, they'll cut back on how much they're eating. But you really need to prioritize that recovery. And people underestimate how much energy is needed to really, truly like have fully recovered muscles, get those glycogen stores topped off again. And so if you're having, you know, that start of a taper and you're not quite ready to start carb loading yet, like I still want people to be eating pretty decently because we want them to go into either that next training load or that race, like really just ready. Like their body is not fatigued at all.
Yeah. So I guess leading in, let's say like week of or something like that, when do you want to start backing off on fiber? That's like a question that I think that most athletes don't understand how fiber is influencing their race day experience. And like you mentioned, the first call porta potty sort of thing, like we always joke around that like it's a really important race when it's, you know, you have to go three times before the race starts, you know, and that's like, that's when you know it's a big race.
Yeah, the nerves definitely like kick in and people just destroy the porta potty.
But fiber has an effect to this.
Yeah,
too,
I mean,
right?
fiber is what creates bulk in our stools. And so usually I tell athletes 2 to 3 days of a lower fiber diet. So don't be eating salads and cruciferous vegetables and broccoli. Like keep it low fiber. Don't do like the big whole grain, you know, pastas. Reduce that fiber. You'll be fine, but it'll just help reduce that risk of having, you know, to go during the race.
Yeah. Ivy, did you have something?
Oh, no, it's just so yummy. I just want like a big crunchy salad, like all the time. It's you know so hard to do yummy? That.
Like toaster strudels and, you know, like all like this stuff, yeah. The nostalgic food from our 90s. This is like the time you can jump in and have it. It's pretty darn good.
Yeah, so. I would do, if you're going to do a salad, do like an iceberg lettuce. That's going to have probably the lowest fiber. But I wouldn't do like, you know, some of the kale, spinach, like, you know, the higher.
Or roughage. I do like, yeah, or like a burrito bowl and I'll just like sprinkle a little bit of lettuce on top. So I'm like, yay, lettuce, but it's not anything.
Just for color. Lettuce. Just there for color.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's, and that's something that also I feel like makes carb decisions a bit easier too, Alex, in the sense that like, since you have less inputs going into whatever is composing your meal, it makes it a bit easier to be like, okay, yeah, I do need to focus on this. And it makes it easier to kind of fill up that plate or that bowl with those sort of carbs that you want leading into it. How far out do you suggest people start carb loading and like intentionally carb loading?
Yeah, well, it'll depend on the race. You know, if you're doing something like Unbound, that's going to be all day long. I mean, I would do a carb load for 3 days. But it also will depend on what you're able to get in a day. And that's why it's nice to practice. Like, I think one of the last episodes I was on, Nate was talking about over 700 grams of carb he would eat in a day. I mean, like, holy smokes, that is.
It was wild.
Massive amount of food in one day. And I like truly asked him, like, you really can eat that much? Like, because I can barely do like 450. And
it was horrific to witness. It was, yeah. It was,
just, yeah. Like, I was shocked. And so not everyone can do that. So it's like, figure out what's really doable for you. And then we can kind of spread it out over a few days. I mean, I've had some athletes that'll even do a 4 day carb load if they really just struggle with hitting those numbers, because we want to get enough carbs in, but we want to make it doable and enjoyable for them too. So they're not like so uncomfortable that they're not sleeping well either.
Yeah. And when you carb load, are you talking about like, what sort of things are ideal in your perspective for carb loading?
So you want to look for foods that are very high carb, but lower in like protein and fat, because I get a lot of athletes that are like, I'm just so full, I can't eat anymore. And I look at their food diary and they're like, you know, doing donuts and tend to be a little bit higher fat. Yes, there's lots of carbs in them, but they are higher fat. Or like they're doing a salad with things and they're doing, you know, high fat yogurt or like a whole bunch of peanut butter on their bagel. And I'm like, okay, let's be a little more strategic here and like cutting back on some of the other macronutrients so that we can hit the carb numbers. So, pancakes, like waffles, pancake syrup on them, oatmeal with brown sugar, cream of, even like, cream of rice or cream of wheat is going to be a little bit lower fiber than oatmeal will be. And you can really load that up with like some maple syrup and that type of stuff. So breakfast foods are always like one of my go-tos, like obviously in the morning, but then even like for dinner at night, and doing just like a little bit of eggs with them, just to have a little bit of protein. And then throughout the day, snacking like high carb granola bars, those naked juice smoothies that are everywhere in the US that you find, like those ones are like 55 grams of carb. And so when you're really just feeling like I can't eat anymore, sometimes just sipping on like those types of juices that are, you can find them if you're traveling, those work really well too.
It's rocket fuel. There's so much sugar. Yes. You're like, whoa.
Yeah, I mean, you could do that in your bowels. You can throw in some, you know, some sort of hydration mix fuel if you really are struggling to hit your numbers. And then also, if your race is going to be really hot and humid, I would do some sort of like preload of sodium as well in like the day before the race and then the morning of the race too, because you know you're just going to lose a lot of electrolytes. So getting a little ahead of the game before the race can be helpful too.
What does a effective preload of sodium look like to you for like the 24 hours before race?
It depends on the athlete. We've had some athletes that we've done some sweat testing and they're losing 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams of sodium an hour for their workouts.
Oh my goodness.
Really high. Wow. So we're like, okay, we're going to preload you with, you know, pretty heavy doses, you know, the day before and then the morning of, just to get you like ready to go for your race. And then that way we don't feel like we're having to really load them up every hour during the race. It depends on how long it is too. But some athletes that are a little bit more normal with their sweat rate, you know, it just more along the lines of like any like water that they're drinking, I'm saying let's throw like some electrolytes in there. It doesn't necessarily have to be something as high as like LMNT, which is 1,000 milligrams of sodium, but something that's like 300 to 500 milligrams with their water throughout the day. Because that's something I see from a lot of athletes. They're like, I got to hydrate. It's going to be super hot. And they drink a ton of water. And then they almost go into their race hyponatremic, like with a low sodium level. There was actually a study that showed they looked at a whole bunch of athletes. I want to say they were runners, like ultra distance runners. And a good portion of them had low sodium levels going into the race, like starting it, because they had just drank so much water and kind of diluted things out. Which
I found that I have like a nervous tic where I'll just like continue to drink.
Yes.
And you know, because I've got a lot of nerves and anticipation and my brain's going on a lot of stuff and I need to physically do something at the same time. That's how my body works. So back when I raced motocross, I remember one year, like I was at this training, camp thing. And I missed like half the training with this like really cool pro athlete because I was just constantly riding back to the bathroom because I was just peeing so much because I was drinking way too much because I was like so much anticipation and so much excitement. So I do the same thing today. I've loaded with, so I typically load with like 1500 the night before and 1500 the morning of.
Yeah.
And it seems like a lot.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. And what I've found when I do that is that, occurrence of cramps tends to drop, does not necessarily always go away. It's not some sort of fail-safe thing. Cramps are complicated. It's not just sodium, but I found that really helps for me. And then that also, like, you know, during the day I might be drinking like a low, like you said, like a 250 milligram or 300 milligram. Like instead of just drinking water, I just drink that. And just having the taste of something slightly different makes me not drink as much because I remember the fact that like, oh, like, cause if it's water, like I'll passively subconsciously just drink, you know, a giant amount of water. And then I'll get to the point where also, I mean, I don't want to like, we're probably, if we're drinking a ton of water and then we're super waterlogged and everything else, we're probably carrying excess weight in the beginning of that race that we don't really need to anyway. So it's all things that are like a really easy to make mistakes with hydrating beforehand for sure.
Yeah. And I just want to say with, the question at hand with Ryan, you know, asking like, what's the best fueling plan leading up to the race? It's the one that's tailored to you. There's no cookie cutter plan out there that's going to work for everyone. So I know that's just a kind of oversimplified answer, but truly like you have to tailor it to you. That's the best plan for sure.
Yeah. And maybe that months of experimentation that you're talking about leading out when you're months out, that's how you can start to figure those things out. Right, Alex?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. You got to do your homework.
Yeah. I have one. Oh, Ivy, go ahead.
Oh, I mean, that was a pretty good tee up to the mentality part of my recommendation, but go for it.
I have one more thing on carbs then, if you don't mind. And then we'll get to the mentality part. Okay. So carb depletion prior to a carb load. There's this concept out there. I don't know if you've used it with athletes or heard of athletes having success with this.
It's kind of an old recommendation that we've kind of debunked at this point. So yeah, there was a theory where if you took a couple days to deplete your carb stores, that then when you carb loaded, you could like load up even more, but they've pretty much debunked that. That's kind of an old school method, and it makes things just extra complicated for people and more likely for there to be some error. So I typically don't recommend doing that, even though I'm sure some athletes do it unconsciously because like, oh, I'm not training, so I don't need to have like all this extra carb. But yeah, I would rather people just focus on the carb loading days and not trying to deplete beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, mentality side. So that's like a really good, well, I guess breakfast, morning of. We didn't cover that. We should cover breakfast, morning of, and then and then we can get into the mentality side. Alex, what should a breakfast look like pre-race? I'm sure the answer is it depends, but...
Yeah, I know. That's my answer to everything, isn't it? But one of the biggest variables for athletes is what's their appetite like, because there's a lot of like pre-race nerves that are going on the morning of, and it can wreak havoc on your appetite, and where you're like, oh my God, the last thing I want to eat is this bagel or this cream of wheat or, you know, whatever it is that you usually have for your like before workout routine. So oftentimes I'll say, let's have a backup plan. If you really just can't get down that solid food, have like some sort of liquid carb source to make up for that, or doing both, like have a small bit of solid food that you can get down and then having whether it's some sports fuel or a smoothie or something to just get some hydration, get some electrolytes and get a good dose of carbs in the morning of. And it depends on when your race starts too. You know, if it's not, you know, if it's a mid-morning start and you've got a lot of time, you're going to probably have like a few breakfasts, or if it's a really early morning start, then you're going to want to get up, get fueled, and try and have, usually I like athletes to do some sort of like gel or energy chews like a half an hour before race start too, just to like have some fresh energy flowing through them, sparing glycogen when they go into that too.
How far out should you pad breakfast ideally before your race?
Well, if you're doing a really large breakfast all at once, I'd give it 2-3 hours at least. But if you're doing kind of like the small, like frequent meals, like you're doing like a meal when you get up right away, and then you've got a few hours, you know, doing a light snack, hour and a half, hour beforehand, I think that's perfectly fine. I think, Ivy, we've talked about pancakes the morning of. Mm-hmm. What was the pancake mix you used? Krusty's?
Yep.
Yeah.
Super easy. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just add water. Cheap everywhere.
Yeah. So, everywhere. I mean, you just have to figure out what works well for you, that you can tolerate really well, what tastes good, what you can get down when your appetite's not feeling the greatest, and when all with all those nerves. And the thing too about some of the solid foods, if you're gonna have a bigger amount, make sure you allow enough time for, because sometimes when you eat that, it will signal your digestive system to move things along, so you can take care of like that bowel movement, bathroom business before your race too, and give you a little extra boost of confidence that you're good to go for the race.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. I've mentioned this before, but rice and eggs, I'll eat like 2 cups of like dry rice before a race. And that's a lot. I'm not saying I just eat the dry rice. I cook it.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the measurement side of things.
Sounds really crunchy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll eat like, it's a lot of rice. If you think of it from that perspective, that's a lot, but
do you like season it with lots of salt and all of that? Like,
I don't spare the salt for sure.
Yeah.
I'll throw in just a touch of pepper or two just to give it like some flavor. And then I mix in some scrambled eggs and I keep it pretty simple though. Like,
yeah.
The one thing I've found is that every ingredient that I add is like a potential aid and also a potential liability. And if there's ever a time to simplify what I'm taking in, the closer to the race I get, the more simple it should be. And when I'm in the race, I want it to be as simple as possible. So then that way, and I mean simple, not in terms of like simple and complex carbohydrates. I'm not speaking directly to that as much as I'm talking about just minimal ingredients, minimal variety, something just I know isn't going to rock the boat. And that's like what I'm trying to do. And I'm getting more and more simple as I get close to it.
And that's super travel friendly too. Like you can go to a grocery store and find like the steam in the bag rice in the frozen department.
Yes.
There's not really anything added to it. And you can cook an egg in a microwave and, you know, you can make mm-hmm. that super easy in like a hotel Airbnb.
And if you're not a psychopath like John and you need some sort of flavor on your rice and egg other than rice and egg, like the travel aspect, little soy sauce packets.
Yeah,
yes. Those are great. And
that
like,
was on my mind too.
Stomach
like,
and sodium.
Like, John, do you like put like soy sauce or something
insane.
In there? Or are you just a monster where you just like
I'm eat robot.
I love the taste of
I
nothing.
The taste of speed, Ivy. So, so this is awesome. I feel like a really great walkthrough. On the like on the bike stuff, we've covered it so much before. Mm-hmm. You can listen to many other episodes, but fair to say, Alex, that athletes should be shooting for, they need to make sure that they're adapted to it, but they need to be shooting for carb replenishment rates of like 80 and above carbs per hour.
Yeah.
Would be ideal for athletes, would you say?
Yeah. Yeah. For races that are going to be over 2-2.5 hours, absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. And for me, I've found like benefit even in short races at making sure that I'm taking in high amounts of carbohydrate. I know that it takes a while for those carbohydrates to actually get to the point where you may be utilizing them. Certainly takes them a while to be able to be, you know, stored as glycogen and to go into that. But I'm just trying to get that bloodstream nice and sugary. So then that way, and once again, we're talking about on the bike in an active state. So we're not talking about incurring some sort of insulin response that's going to then cause, yes. you know, diabetes and everything else. But during the race, I want that to be high. I want my blood sugar to be as high as possible. So then that way that's, you know, kind of like a mainline source of energy that my body can use, for quick replenishment. And then, yeah, fueling all throughout, but I feel like we've covered that ad nauseum, to some people. So hopefully this is a good walkthrough on the mentality side, Ivy. I feel like this is, we don't talk a whole lot about this. I actually, it'd be really good to get like a sports psych that works with endurance athletes and get them to come onto the podcast occasionally. I feel like it could be really fun to deal with that. Cause I feel like this is an overlooked aspect, right, Ivy? Like of how to prepare yourself for the race. Cause I've also been in situations where I have, maybe I've checked all the boxes otherwise, but mentally speaking, I worked myself out of the race or out of whatever, of being able to even achieve what I wanted to just with my mental state.
Right. And I think I've struggled in seasons past where wanting to perform well and feeling nervous going into a race and having people in my circle just be like, well, just be confident and just believe in yourself. And I felt totally delulu, like completely delusional, like under what grounds do I have to believe that I be confident that I can do this? Like I have no reason to believe it. Just because I pedaled hard in some workouts and they went okay doesn't mean I can perform today. Like that's insane. So for me, I think one of the biggest things, like everything that we just talked about, like Alex and John, all your recommendations, like every little bit of it, equipment, doing your pre-race check, knowing how long it takes, nutrition strategy, carb loading, hydration, electrolyte loading the days before. I cannot stress this enough and recommend it enough and cannot speak enough to how much it has helped me as an athlete with my mentality to know that I know what to do to treat training days in the months and weeks before your event like a race day. You have to do it. I treat really hard workouts like this. If I don't have a race ride, I incorporate local road race rides into my training and treat it as a race day. And if the volume's not just right, like I'll try to add on a little extra after or before, but I treat those days like race days or a really hard workout like a race day months before so that I know exactly how long it takes me to do this equipment check where I run through every bolt and every battery and check out my sealant and knows how long I know exactly how long it takes me to do all that. So it's not new and stressful the week before my race. I know exactly what it feels like to try to carb load for a couple days before. I know exactly how hard it is to slam drink mix for the whole day before when I really don't want to. You know, I know exactly how boring and lame it is to eat rice and eggs on a Tuesday morning when I really don't feel like it.
It's cool for me, Ivy.
You know, If it's hot, I'll go anyways, and I will show up with a race sock in my jersey to a race ride, to a local group ride. I don't care. I do all these things so that in the mentality aspect, I know it's not just about like I know that I've prepared in my training for this event. It's that I know exactly how my body's going to react in these circumstances. I know what it feels like to carb load. I know what happens to my body on the bike when I do all these things and check all these boxes. And that's what gives me confidence. It makes you believe in yourself and your performance because it's so much more than just like, how hard can you pedal and did you pedal every chance that you got and do these workouts? Like we know that it's so much more complex than that. And so that's why I strongly urge if you have a big goal in mind, a big event, you don't have to go like duplicate the effort. You have to duplicate the mental state that you'll be in the days, the hours, the weeks before an event, and just treating a hard workout like your race day does that for me. Is there not a race ride in your local town? Build one. Is there not like a community Facebook page or an Instagram page for group rides and race rides and there's no race ride yet? Make one, you know, throw it. Just be like, hey, let's meet at this time. If anyone want to like do race efforts and do a drop ride and we'll race to this point, like let's do it. And I bet other people will be into it too. So yeah, I really strongly urge athletes that want to feel more at ease about the preparation they've done in all these categories to simulate it, during your training, months before your event, so that you're confident, you know what to expect. It just puts you at ease on race day.
Yeah, this is managing expectations and like setting expectations for yourself coming into an event is so important. And I feel like usually what happens is that we view that through the lens of a numerical result relative to others. It may be the case that that's where your expectations do need to be set. You know, maybe you're going for a national championship. Then it entirely matters where you place relative to others, right? But in, I think that a lot of that's discouraging. And honestly, for most people, except for maybe two, three, they shouldn't be thinking about that first place spot. And instead, they should be thinking about something else, whatever the outcome is in that race that they have prepared for best. And what I see, though, is a lot of athletes, because they have been scorned before from saying, like, I should win, or I should get X, or I should get X time on this race. And then afterward, they just go into races with no expectations whatsoever, because they don't want to go through that disappointment, that disillusion, like you mentioned, Ivy, where you feel like delusional. You're just like, I thought that I could do this. Like, what am I doing? I'm out here in this race, and I'm not even close to what I thought I was going to achieve. And it can spiral and cause something that's not just spiraling for the race, but spiraling for months and years with racing. And it makes racing really unenjoyable. I really liked how you talked about belief. It comes from knowing what you can do, what you have done recently, and knowing you can execute on that. And that's the most important thing. Somebody out there is going to know from executing like they have been executing and preparing like they've been preparing that they can win. And so they may have the goal to win. For a lot of other people, you should go into this and just think, okay, what's my main goal here? My main goal is to hit X, Y, and Z in terms of my nutrition, my equipment, my pacing. And I've done this in training, so I should expect that in this race. And that's what I'm going to hold myself to, and I'm going to go for it. And that's a way better way to like manage those expectations and to build belief in yourself. There's this, like, you know, we know that we could get hurt by setting having poorly set expectations and then going into a race environment and having that dissonance between them. So we tend to avoid whatever source of potential hurt, you know, and we can just like block ourselves away from it. But man, racing is so much more fulfilling when you focus on what you have done recently and you know you can do, and then you go out and you try to execute like that in a race. Like, amazing advice, Ivy. I feel like it's for me, the visualization side is really important, especially in triathlon for me, because I'm still, there's a whole lot of unknown, and there's like so many in a bike race. It's just like, you know, you get on the bike and you go out in your race, and you might have mechanicals, you might have other things, don't get me wrong. But on a triathlon, it's like there's transitions, there's different equipment, there's other people, there's getting into water, which is terrifying for me still. So like, there's all these different things that, yeah, I deal with. And what I've had to do is go through every single one of those. And my visualization process is not like I sit down on the couch and I visualize for an X amount of minutes. It is months of me putting myself into this scenario. And then what I see is when I go through things and then I see and I visualize something bad happening, it's probably coming from some sort of like subconscious level of fear, or maybe quite conscious level of fear. I have learned to not shy away from that and instead see myself get into the depths of that situation and then think my way out of it and what I can do coming out of it. Then that typically ends up making me train slightly differently or do something different in my preparation leading up to it, because I've seen, okay, this could happen and how could I overcome it? And then I have this broad experience and I get there on race day where I'm like, all right, if this happens, I know to do this. If this happens, I know to do this. And it allows me to think through everything. That's really helpful also, particularly in things like crit racing, where it's just so dynamic and dependent on other people. You should not go into it thinking that like my lead out will be perfect. I will be fifth wheel. They will let me go with 200 meters to go and it will be beautiful. Like, you know, like it doesn't work that way. You need to go into these situations and think like, okay, so what happens when the team jumps our train? What happens when my lead out riders fall off? What happens when we don't get into position and I need to move on my own? What happens when there's a crash? It's like, you have to think through all of those things, but don't do it right before the race. This is something that you should be thinking about when you start training. When you start training for an event months in advance, this is when you want to start looking through all this stuff. And that's a consistent thing that I found with the best athletes. Like, they are so like, they get to the race and they've seen it all. They've already lived it all because they went through it so commonly in their mind beforehand. And that's what makes it so easy to have belief in yourself when you get there, because it's like, well, I know how to get through these things and I know what I've done and I know what I can do.
You know, they've gone through it in their mind and they've also practiced it. And this is the value of doing like a race ride, and practicing timing your sprint. What happens when it's too slow and it's four across the road? What happens when it's, you know, you don't get to be in the right spot and you have to reshuffle? And this doesn't just apply to road. It applies to XC, just doing like a weekly chiller race and getting to practice that stuff. It can apply to gravel. Like what happens when I paced horribly and went way too hard on this first climb? How do I recover? How do I respond? You know, I think it goes so much more beyond visualizing it and having the practice and knowing that you can respond appropriately or knowing what you want to do helps that visualization. Don't you think?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's one thing I want to add too. If you don't have a race ride, you can do so many silly things to make yourself work harder than you would otherwise. Like, one thing that I did, this involves other people, but there's other ways you can do it. I remember, this is during COVID and I was like really trained up and I was like, I'm going to do my own stage race. And, I had like an XCO loop that I was going to do. And I gave my son an air horn and it's kind of like a XC course that in this, I could hear the air horn in every spot. And I made sure that he knew that he couldn't just beep the air horn every like 10 seconds, even though he totally wanted to. But occasionally my wife would let him beep the air horn. And every time he did that, I had to attack. And my rule was I had to attack for 2 minutes as hard as I could and like hold on for 2 minutes and then not go through. Made for a super hard XCO race because my son really liked to beep the horn. So like, but that's like, you could do something that. Like that.
That's yeah, so creative. That's awesome.
Go into a situation like if you have like a safe area of road, commonly are in like industrial parks and it's like after hours where you're going to have like low traffic, anything like that. Make it so that if anytime you see a vehicle that's like a primary color, you have to attack. Or anytime you see like you have something that happens that's random, you have to attack. That kind of keeps you on your toes. And that sort of thing can make it so that you can get these like really dynamic workouts that are not pre-planned, that are not allowing you to attack when you want to attack, that are stretching your bounds and limits that might be similar to your race. And in terms of how you replace that within your training plan, because you don't want to just be layering things on top of, you should be looking at whatever workout would be most similar to that race ride you're doing. You can delete that workout for the week and then consider that your workout. However, just know that you shouldn't expect the same exact outcomes. They aren't the same thing, but this is just a way to avoid getting too much stress if you're ended up doing that. But it can be so helpful. It can be a really good way to go about things. So, Alex, I don't know if you have any thoughts on the mentality side or any suggestions there.
When you guys were talking, it reminded me of a post on Instagram from Steve Magnus, who is a run coach. And the post said, one of my favorite tools I learned from athletes I coached was let your mind go to a dark place in practice, then see if you can get out of it. Instead of avoiding the doubts and insecurities, practice going there in a secure environment so you are ready on game day. And when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, I had never even considered like practicing going to a dark place in my training. Like I would just avoid those uncomfortable situations. And therefore I wasn't prepared for them on race day. And that really kind of has stuck out to me just recently in like how you think about your training. And from a nutrition aspect, I tell a lot of my athletes, I'm like, hey, I see this a lot where an athlete thinks that they know they had a good workout when they feel like completely depleted and spent when they finish it. And I said, I'm going to challenge that. I want you to feel like you could have gone harder. You could have gone, like you could still go farther. Like you still feel really good and you have energy the rest of the day, because that is what gives you the confidence to keep training and that you're ready for your race. When I hear from athletes, especially my Ironman training athletes, you know, there's always a point in their training where they're like losing some motivation to train. They're kind of feeling a little burnt out. And that is a sign that we need to up their calories, because they're just needing more fuel. And so from like that mindset thing too, is like, don't let it get you down. Instead, reflect on what can I do to help get me out of this funk it might be nutrition because you just don't have enough energy going in.
100%. Like, yes, it's so important. That's why we always talk about fueling and making sure you're fueling the work and doing all of that, because it's not as compartmentalized and clean as we like to think. Mm-hmm. They are absolutely interrelated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's a really good walkthrough in terms of like what you can do for nutrition, like going into a race, leading up to it, what you can do for equipment, and obviously the mentality side. Again, if you're a sports psych or you know a sports psych that's worked with endurance athletes, cyclists or triathletes in particular, reach out, trainroad.com/podcast. It'd be great to have somebody on at some point with this. So, okay, we're going to go into some quick questions. DJ says, all this talk about heat adaptation has me thinking, for long rides and races in hot conditions, is it better to have the largest bottles without insulation or to have insulated bottles which hold a few less ounces, more than a few? It's actually like a pretty significant drop down that you get with those insulated bottles, but keep things ice cold. I'm about to buy some bigger bottles for a mid-July race, but the largest insulated bottles out there are 24 ounces, while the non-insulated can be found up to 32 ounces. And I bet DJ's talking about the Zefal bottles. I bet somebody's going to be like, where are those? Z-E-F-A-L. Those are the ones that I get. They're big dogs. Those things carry a bunch.
They're pretty hard to find, but I did just find, or that brand is hard to find. But Specialized also makes a 32-ounce bottle.
There we go.
That is found. Yeah.
Is it insulated?
No, it's not insulated.
Oh, okay.
It's 32 ounces though. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to find. So like 32 ounces, I think, is equivalent roughly to 1,000, like a liter,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, it's almost a liter.
Yeah.
Also those, the classic green Gatorade bottles. They're 32 ounces and you can get them at like Target or online or whatever, but, they really don't fit in bottle cages very well.
No, they're too big.
They're not cycling bottle shaped.
Have you noticed how with some bottle cages, if you use a too big of a bottle, it can like stretch or warp your bottle cage. And then thereafter, yeah, like everything's going to be loose. Yeah. It's totally, or you break your bottle cage and then you're really
out of luck. Yeah. And the like mouthpiece is weird too. It's not like a normal cycling thing. It's like made for like sports guys that like blast it, you know, like, I don't know. Yeah. Football guys.
It's designed for that spring in the face thing, for sure.
Yeah.
Not the same. What would you do? I mean, this look like, scientifically speaking, there probably is some sort of correct answer, but I looked for a lot of different studies that was looking into this. We are going to be doing some videos coming up that on our Instagram channel and YouTube channel that look into like most effective cooling regions of the body and what you can do to help with that, which will be fun. So check that out. But aside from that, I really, this is more of our us just to share our opinions. What say you, Ivy? What would you do?
My strategy for this, and this is for really, really hot days when I know that, when I'm sure that anything I freeze is actually going to fully eventually melt. Like, this is silly when you try to freeze like half a bottle or some bottle and it never actually gets hot enough and you're parched and there's just like a rock of ice rolling out of there and you're like, please. Yeah.
It's a ballast. It's just like, trailing with more weight.
Yeah. So if I know that it's going to be really hot and that something that's frozen will actually fully melt, I will partially freeze bottles the night before, but it's strategic. So you don't want to do, you don't want to just do frozen all the way to the top. They won't melt in time. You need to start drinking. So I'll do one bottle that's like half frozen and plan on that being the one that I'll start drinking first. And then the other one, and again, this is for super, super hot, so I know that it's going to fully melt. I'll freeze it about 75%. And so I plan on drinking that one later, you know, like an hour and a half later. If it's a 32-ounce bottle, like I'll probably want to drink as much as I can. But if I need to, that I plan on that being my second bottle and I try to freeze it a little bit more than half so that by the time I get done with that first one, it's still really cold. So that's my strategy.
Yeah. What would you say, Alex? Good tips, Ivy.
Well, it depends on the race, I guess. Is there going to be like 8-station bottle exchanges? How far apart are they? And then what's your goal rate of fluid that you need to be drinking between, like in that period of time? Because I do sometimes see athletes that are like, oh, I don't want the bigger bottle because it's going to weigh down my bike. And I'm like, well, dehydration is going to cost you a lot more than the weight of your bottles. So that's something to just consider too, is kind of doing the math of how much do I need realistically? Am I going to be able to refill or bottle exchange? Or is this something like what I take with is what I what I'm going to have. So then I'd say do the bigger bottle and do the strategy of IV freezing part of it. Yeah. And I typically won't freeze. I won't put my bottles in the freezer with the top on it because I don't want.
Oh, I should have said that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want the mouthpiece to get ruined from.
It gets frozen.
It gets frozen. But yeah, sometimes I'll try and tip the bottles a little bit so that like you can get, I don't know, like the water.
Theoretically, you might have more surface area and it could
I don't know. Like, I like it.
Engineers, engineers, chime in. Let us know
the
ideal angle for the bottle within the freezer.
Yeah.
Somebody is like calculating it right now. If my brother was listening, he would totally be doing that. So,
yeah. And especially, you know, by the time you get up, you grab your stuff, you get to the race, how much melting is it going to happen? You know, there's a little bit of strategy involved there too. And bring extra and just kind of see, you know, what bottle is frozen or thawed enough that you can throw on your bike when you start the race too.
And make sure you understand what effect drink mix has, your specific drink mix has on freezing and thawing rates. So one thing I found is that if with my carb mixes or something like Marten, it does not freeze as fast as what you would get with normal water. And in some cases, it actually never fully freezes like rock hard. It's kind of like porous, so it melts pretty quick. But the advantage to that is maybe you can freeze it more eagerly in the sense that like you could just put the whole Camelback reservoir or something like that in the freezer and then it thaws out. That's one thing you can do for sure. I would, so I've of course very specific ideas on what I would do here. I would always aim for more. And like Alex said, in terms of hydration, but also in terms of carbohydrate, like I want to have more carbohydrate on board. And if using an insulated bottle is going to make it so that I can't take that in, I'm fine with drinking a hot carbohydrate drink over having cold, but not carbs. You know what I mean? Like it's the temperature really gets down to pickiness and like tough to stomach maybe, but train for that. Get used to that. Like get used to practice. Not drinking everything at ideal temperature. And that way you can carry more volume and it's going to be better off for you. However, I would use insulated ones if you know that you're going to be able to get bottles. Are you in a race where you're going to be able to like pick up bottles every lap? If so, that's the case, then yeah, like you might want to use insulated ones just so that you know it's always going to be really cold because that could lower your core temperature. So even though this seems kind of counterintuitive, if I was doing a hot XCO race, I would want small insulated bottles, the smallest ones I could find and insulated. So then that way I can, when I grab that bottle every lap or every other lap, whatever it is, I don't need a full bottle. I can just have a little bit of drink mix in there because I'm passing through every 15 minutes or something or 20 minutes. But then that way I know that like it's insulated and it's going to be really cold. And that way it can really make it so that it's a whole lot easier. That makes it way better for your pit crew too. So then they don't have to maybe worry about carrying a cooler or anything else in those sort of situations. The bottles can keep themselves cold. So that can be a really helpful way to do it. If it's a long race and it's really hot, I still would probably go for more volume because volume is really, really important. Maybe there's other ways that you can cool off your body as well. And then hopefully you can refuel and do that sort of thing. So last tip I would say is freeze your entire hydration pack the night before. Throw the whole pack into the freezer and get it wet first. And like that way you'll have a crispy, crunchy pack that you put on. But the benefit to that is the fact that it's going to still retain some cooling and some moisture that's going to start to, you know, melt out on you. I have the Truckee or Tahoe Truckee gravel or race. I think that's the name of the race this weekend, which by the time you're listening to this, it will have already happened. Hope to see you there. It's supposed to be almost 100 degrees. It's going to be really hot. And in that one, I'm going to absolutely freeze my hydration pack beforehand and make sure to have something like that in place. Even though it's going to be cold in the start, it's going to pay off later on.
I do have a tip for freezing your hydration packs because you can
don't freeze the hose.
Fill them up all the way, you know, because ideally you want it to be full of fluid. And once you freeze things, they expand. And so sometimes the ice can expand into the hose. Even if you don't fill it up all the way or position it wrong, water can get in the hose and freeze, and then like you might be ready to drink and it might not have thawed there. So my strategy for that is leave some space, like an air bubble, in your hydration pack, and then angle it, try to position it in your freezer so that the hose and that that junction is on the top of the bag so that you don't get ice in there. And then in the morning when it's frozen, if it hasn't fully expanded to the top and there's room for 2 more ounces of fluid, okay, top it off then. But you really don't want to get that frozen and then it doesn't thaw and then you're thirsty and in trouble.
Good tip, Ivy. One thing you can do if you get water in the hose and you don't know how to do it, you can also just blow back into your hydration pack too. And it's like a small little thing. And that way, if you have a little bit of water in your hose that would freeze and block it otherwise, you can just blow that back into the rest of the reservoir. So small detail. Okay, next one. Barry says, hey, coaches, thanks for all your awesome content. You mentioned that you have more than 100,000 people listening to the podcast, and it makes sense why. You're giving away huge amounts of useful information for free. Additionally, considering how many people listen to the podcast, it seems more people need to rate it on Spotify.
Yeah, Barry says, you're welcome, like Jonathan. That it's free? Do you like not having to listen to ads? Go sign up right now.
Yes.
Thank you. That's it.
Sign up for Trainer Road. We get even more features out. It's amazing. So, and share, rate that podcast on Spotify. Barry is correct. Very few of you have rated the podcast and we appreciate it if all of you did. So, and thanks to everyone who does. That's how more people find it. Barry says, my question has to do with caffeine intake on the bike versus off the bike. When I drink my black coffee this morning, I roughly calculate 100 milligrams of caffeine, and it honestly just makes me feel normal. In other words, I don't notice any boost from the caffeine. Meanwhile, if I take a Mar-10 caffeine gel during a race, I feel like my throttle is wide open and I'm jittery. Do you know why this is or if it is common? I'm wondering if it's due to the caffeine being different between the two or if it is due to some other dietary factor that comes with a race context. Thanks for any experience you can provide. Do you have any ideas or hunches or anything on this one, Alex?
Yeah, I've got a few theories here.
All right.
First is, like, are you chugging the coffee like you would take a caffeinated gel? Like, probably not.
Good point. Slam it down.
The other thing would be, this could be a big factor, is like typically when people drink their coffee, they're also eating breakfast of some sort or have had breakfast. Mm-hmm. And so that can slow down digestion. And, you know, when you have those like mixed meals of nutrition combined with it, definitely can give you a much more steadier, absorption of caffeine. And then also a factor would be, you know, he said roughly calculated with his coffee, like the strength of coffee can vary. So what you think may be 100 milligrams of caffeine in your coffee may actually not be quite that. So those were a few of the things that came to mind. And also just the fact that during your race, you kind of do have an empty stomach somewhat. Mm. And so that Morton gel might get absorbed a lot quicker than your coffee will in the morning.
Yeah. And you're likely or more likely to be dehydrated, I feel like, too. Yeah. I know that when you wake up in the morning, you're also technically dehydrated, but this is like a different level in a race. Mm-hmm. Also, it's kind of like all the taps are open when you're in a race. Yeah. Like your body is digesting that sort of sugary stuff so fast. You take it down fast. It's like, so it is going to hit harder. I have noticed, I feel like, that when you just get like raw caffeine supplementation, like whether it's through caffeine pills or anything else, I do feel like I've noticed at different times where it feels like the one has hit harder than another, but there's so many variables that, like Alex just pointed out, I have nowhere near a well-controlled enough life to be able to say that, like, indeed this brand had more kick than another, because mm-hmm. my life is variable, but I feel like I have, for what it's worth, recognized this before. So in the question of whether it's common, I'd be curious to hear other athletes, if you experience this too, or you feel like caffeine from gels hits harder than caffeine from perhaps other like normal food or drink sources that you're dealing with.
Yeah. I like to be really strategic with caffeine for athletes because, like, do you really want to have that like jittery jolt of caffeine? Mm. Like maybe if you're in a really dark place, like in where like morale is really low during your race, or is it just something that you want to just have a little steady maintenance of caffeine, you know, at a certain point of the race to keep you going and keep you like mentally clear too. Cause caffeine isn't going to replace, you know, a good nutrition plan, but it does give you, you know, it gives you the perception that you're not as fatigued as you actually are.
Yeah. Ivy, what are your thoughts on this? I don't know if you have any specific like guidelines that you follow for caffeine in a race.
No, more is more. It's awesome.
I feel like that is unsafe.
There is a point where it doesn't it doesn't improve performance, and excessive caffeine can impact GI issues pretty significantly.
Totally.
It can have a bit of a laxative effect if you're having too much. So you do want to be careful of that. And keep in mind that it typically takes about an hour for typically, and everyone metabolizes it a little bit different, but about an hour is when it will peak in your blood. With the exception of like run gum or any of that, those oral caffeine where it's absorbed sublingually, then it's more like a half hour.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are heart health implications too. Like slamming a Red Bull or a Monster every single day or yeah. too frequently. Don't do that. I had a teammate once that was worked in the healthcare field, and I had a 8-ounce Red Bull before a crit, and she was so upset with me. She's like, you're gonna have a heart attack. Those are linked to heart issues, this and that. And I'm like, Miss Girl, I'm doing this like once every 2 weeks before a crit. Like, it's going to be okay.
So, also, more is more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I think I have a different sensitivity to caffeine, just because I drink a lot of coffee during the day. Like, I like it. So I kind of do use that more is more approach on race day. Like, sometimes I need a little more and I'm not afraid of it.
I'm not like Ivy. I need to like be very careful about how much caffeine I take in, because it can throw off my day, from whether it's like a nerves and focus point where I can just get too wired as a result and kind of like lose track of things. Or, and more commonly, it really messes up my gut. And that's why I've switched to run gum. It's a slower release. Don't feel as jittery. I still get that heightened awareness. My RPE drops significantly when I take it as well. The other thing though is I do not want to take caffeine unless I know that I can take more caffeine and not surpass my limits too early in a race. Cause that's like if you feel that drop off, that's the sort of thing that can really just like, you know, when it's like the final nail in a coffin sort of a scenario, you know, you might have been like all ready to go and fueled up and super strong, but then at the end of the race, when you ran out of caffeine and you don't have it, and then you hit that drop that you get after taking a lot of it, it can be really bad. So you have to time it right. I'm making sure that I'm not taking it too early on in a race, and I'm timing it with the time when I think I'm going to need it most.
So yeah, when I'm it's gonna be definitely most good tired. To trial your caffeine in advance. But if you know, like our athletes that we talked about earlier who are working out in the evenings, you might want to, you know, wait for a morning weekend workout where you can trial some caffeine, because they're never going to fall asleep if they're trialing it at 8:30 at night.
Yeah, and do what feels safe. Don't like send yourself to the hospital because you wanted to like have a good workout. Like, everybody be cool, you know.
Do not do more is more. We will cut that out. Don't do that. All right. Devin says, I'm doing a multi-day credit card bikepacking trip through the Pisgah and Nantahala National Forest. I think that's how you'd say that one. In mid-July with a group of friends. For those who don't know credit card bikepacking, Ivy, do you want to explain kind of what the premise is? Or I don't know if you know that term, but
yeah, I use that term for a tour or a bikepacking trip where you aren't packing supplies to sleep and eat. So you're staying in Airbnbs or hotels or crashing with friends or whatever. And then you aren't doing like jet boil camping food or preparing food like that. You're stopping at restaurants, cafes, like stuff like that. So really what you're packing is fresh riding clothes, tools that you might need, casual clothes for when you're not riding, and on the bike, hydration and food, and that's about it.
Yep. Yeah, nailed it. Devin says, we'll be eating breakfast and dinner at restaurants, hopefully, but throughout the day, all of my nutrition intake will be on the bike. Looking at historical weather, we could be in extremely hot and humid conditions or cool and rainy conditions. So how would you suggest that I adjust my fueling strategy on the bike for those two different conditions? Anything I should change with my breakfast or dinner? Final note, I'll have a Camelback, 2 bottles on my bike, a water filter, a frame bag, a bar bag, and a big saddlebag, so I'll have plenty of room to carry food along the way. Ivy, you're getting ready for a bikepacking trip, I think, this coming week.
Yeah. So I definitely want to leave the like strategy of how you might fuel differently for different temperatures. I'll leave that for Alex. But I do want to suggest if you go into this trip and you learn that it is going to be really hot and humid, the only thing I would suggest is that you try to organize your frame bag so that you can leave your hydration bladder in the very top horizontally of your frame bag. And really, that's just to help with cooling. Having that camelback or hydration pack on your back just makes you feel so hot. And so if you can do anything to try to arrange your stuff so that you can be have your hydration on the bike and then just thread the hose through the very end of the zipper and drink that way, like that really helps me keep cool on long, hot, slow tours. And especially when your bike is all loaded up, like you really don't get to move very quickly. And sometimes you might be on like big exposed, you know, climbs and just, it's just miserable. And so to have a hydration pack when you're in those settings is just a huge bummer. So that's what I would suggest for a really hot setting. But in terms of your strategy, Alex, what do you think for like, if it's cold, like, would you change your strategy if it's cold?
The only thing, if it's like really cold and rainy and you know you're not sweating as much, you don't probably need to like push the salty foods as much, you know what I mean? But when it's hot and humid, like I'd be going for, I definitely wouldn't do any fried foods regardless of the weather conditions. I would be looking for just high carb. I know.
Like no gas station corn dogs.
No tendies. No tendies.
No corn dogs. Try and play it safe. No salads. Like I would just be like, I'm thinking like breakfast. breakfast potatoes, like hash browns with ketchup, you know, pancakes, waffles, the carb stuff. I'd skip like the really heavy omelets and like, yeah, you can have some protein, but, you know, looking for carbs, looking for some salt, especially, I mean, then like load up the ketchup, load up the salt on the hot and humid conditions. And then dinner, you're looking at both protein and carbs just to try and rehydrating. Like that's going to be like your job when you get done. And then a bedtime snack, if you can just kind of catch up. But yeah, I mean, I'm assuming he's going to do gas station stuff, you know, midday for lunch. So pick stuff that's going to be safe for that. I mean,
not roller dogs.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I know that those things can sound really good, but like, yeah, try and play it safe with no gas station sushi. Like, yeah.
No, this forbidden sushi right there. Yeah.
This brings up a good point about what's so tricky about trips like this when you're, you know, stopping at places like diners to eat breakfast and stuff and you're counting on that for breakfast every day instead of, you know, like packing you know, a JetBoil and the food that you know is like simple and easy and will digest quick and is good. This is so tempting to be like, give me the Denver omelet and, you know, or like Eggs Benedict and just like greasy, yummy diner food. And it's so hard to be like, I'll have just a short sack of pancakes with nothing on them. Thank you so much. Like it's such a bummer.
Yeah. I mean, you can definitely do the omelet, but I would like have that side of hash browns. I'd probably bring I'm thinking of like Perkins. When I was a kid, I'd always go like, get an omelet. I'd get the hash browns and it was either like pancakes or muffin or what's the option. And so like you want to get those carb things in there too. Because it's all about loading up on that glycogen. You can get through the day feeling good. But they're such fun like trips. So, I mean, when it's a multi-day, like it gets to the point where any calorie is a good calorie, but
yeah,
I would avoid the fried foods and I would look for like the high carb, high salt. Yeah. If it's, and keep in mind when it's rainy and cool, you're cold on the bike, your body is using extra calories to stay warm too. So that's something to consider, is that factor as well.
Yeah. And I feel like you're probably, no matter what, you are going to want to take in a lot of sodium on the bike, a lot of carbohydrate on the bike. If it gets really hot, you'll just want to make sure that you're doubling down on that. And then any chance you have to take in extra fluid with sodium, then you want to take it in. But really, the on the bike stuff isn't going to change a whole lot there. You just want to look for cold sources, ways to cool yourself down. I know that region has like a lot of water crossings, creeks, everything else. So like, you know, be a Labrador and splash yourself and get into the water as much as you can.
Cool off
if it gets hot, you know.
That sounds so fun. I do have one tip for if it is cold and rainy and you think you're going to be cold and stopping at gas stations and stuff. Most gas stations that have coffee and hot stuff will just have hot water and cups and miso packets. The dried like soup miso packets are really great for that because it doesn't sound great to just slam cold drink mix to get sodium. And so to go warm up in a gas station with a packet of miso soup that you brought is amazing. Such a good pick me up.
Yeah. Or like hot cocoa packets. I was thinking too, if they happen to, you could pick some up at like a market. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a good one. Okay. That was the last question, but Alex, while we still have you, we just want to, we're doing single track six. The next episode, I just want to run through this for all our listeners. So this episode will be published on July 6th. After that, we are not going to have a regular episode the following week. So we are going to have on Wednesday, July 12th, that will be the race preview. And then on Thursday, stage one, Ivy and I will have raced. We're going to have some sort of like, like real world confessional style podcast where we're like, this is what we did great. And this is what we did not do great. And here's what we've learned. And we're going to do that for every stage. They aren't going to be particularly long podcasts. They're going to be short ones. And we're just going to share our learnings and kind of like give you like a very brief overview of the stages that we've done to give you some context. So that will be July 13th is stage one. And then we end up finishing on July 18th. That's Tuesday, July 18th on stage six. We're going to have a podcast every single day, all the way through the race from that, which would be pretty great. There'll be short ones. You can tune in and see how we're doing. We're going to have video on this too. So it'll be on our YouTube channel. So you can see Ivy. It'd be great. Ivy and I, so then you can see us and like juxtapose day one and how like fresh or on the preview, how fresh and happy we were. And then on day six, how cracked we look by the end of it, it'll be fun to watch. So that's going to be the publishing schedule. But Alex, for some context here, 6 days of mountain bike racing through Eastern BC and Western Alberta, really like rugged single track terrain. So it will be on. The stages will be like 2.5 to 3.5 hours, I think, for us, depending on the day and everything else. Intensity is going to be really high during the whole race. Like this is not like a 2.5 hour to 3.5 hour chill session. The course doesn't even allow that. Just the climbs are too steep. Like it will be hard for 2.5 to 3.5 hours every day. I think we'll start probably sometime around 8 or 10 a.m. In the mornings. That's when it's slotted to start us. And then some days we'll have to drive after the stage for 1 to 3 hours, depending on like the transfers that we have. Weather right now, who knows, but it looks like thunderstorms pretty much every day. And it's going to be 70, but that's like afternoon thunderstorms that they build up and then they let out in the afternoons. 70 to 85 degrees Fahrenheit or 21 to 29 degrees Celsius is like the high, but I think that we're going to be racing in relatively cooler conditions, like 65 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 to 24 C. And that's kind of what we're doing. Altitude, we are going to be racing from 3,000 to 6,000 feet or 1,000 to 2,000 meters. So like we will have to take into account like the nutritional considerations for being at altitude, but for me, that's normal. My training elevation is about 6,000 feet, 6,500. Ivy is at 3,200 feet, but Ivy agrees with Keegan that elevation isn't real and she just, you know, manages it just fine. So, yeah, works. Me too. I'm in the same boat. It's not real. So flat earthers and us. And then, next bit, we are going to be cooking, but it's going to be done with like camping equipment. I'm going to have a van and that has like, you know, minimal like kitchenette sort of stuff. I think I'll have a microwave and like a stove. And then we will have a small fridge and then like coolers as well. But Alex, what comes to mind in terms of like we already talked about breakfast stuff. So we probably don't have to cover that.
I mean, about you can bring your rice. You can bring your Krusty's pancake mix. Like you guys are pretty set like for breakfast, I feel like.
Post-stage, what should we look to do post-stage and then for dinner? Because we will have snacks covered. Ivy and I will be eating like eating awesome food like it's our job after that. Like, you know.
Yeah, and that was kind of my thought too, especially when you said that you might be driving 1 to 3 hours after the stage. I was like, oof, that is going to be prime time to have something in the car while you're driving, both like in your bottle and I would say like eating something as well, whether that's like snacking on like some beef jerky to get some lean protein in, or doing a protein, like mixing in some protein recovery beverage in your bottle as you rehydrate. Some chips for like some extra just salt and carbs, you know, like just some plain potato chips. I like
all
of this.
This all sounds wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, those things are going to be light, easy to like travel with, access, you know, they're going to be safe. Like those are the things that I would be looking for, immediately post stage would be as soon as you're done, get some carbs, get some protein, rehydrate. And then when you're having dinner, you know, again, looking for the carbs, the protein, get yourself recovered as quickly as possible. And then if you can do like a bedtime snack too, just help with recovery overnight.
Nice. What about Little Debbie cherry pies? The small ones.
Yes.
Are those advisable? Yes. Good. Yes. We have permission. That's wonderful.
Totally.
Yeah. I'll bring approved. Many of them. Awesome.
Yeah. I just did a blog post where I was reviewing energy drink or energy bars and the Betty Lou's energy bars. I have an order coming right now in the mail. It's getting shipped. But they have like, they look like they're basically like they taste like pie. Ooh. Yeah, they taste like pie, yeah. But in an
the
energy
PB&J
bar.
PB&J bars. I've had those before.
Yeah.
They're tasty.
Yeah, the dietitians that are on my team said they are delicious. So I'm really excited to taste test those. And my kids are also equally just as excited to taste test them.
I bet.
So those could be an option too, you know, in addition to your Little Debbie cherry pies.
Nice. Ivy, do you have anything like eyeing what you're going to have after the stage or like anything else? Anything you're looking forward to for food?
Oh, I'm bringing absolutely everything. My car is going to be so stuffed.
Amazing.
With like quick snacks, things like beef jerky, like backpacking, like sweet mango sticky rice that I just have to add hot water to in case I need carbs quick and sugar. Backpacking food meals that I can just like coconut curries and things like that I can just like pour hot water into if I really, really need more. I'm not going to be hungry at all ever during this.
This is honestly like the highlight of doing these types of events is just being able to eat all that stuff. It's a perk of what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I think that, you know, with mountain biking and all, Ivy, like with power, I think that I'll be close to burning 1,000 calories an hour with power. But then with everything else that you're doing on the bike, we will be burning more. And that's just on the bike. And then it's off the bike. Your body is just like an absolute furnace trying to like recover. So it's like, you know, the rate at which you're using calories goes up so much. And prior experience with stage races and really screwing it up, then also doing it quite well at Cape Epic in terms of nutrition. Yeah, you just can't eat enough. Like, I know Cape Epic was even bigger, but in this case, try eating, you know, 4,000 extra calories a day. That's really, really hard. And that's basically what we're going to be, you know, 3,000, 4,000 calories just on the bike and then even more afterwards. So it'll be tough. I'm stoked. I'm also looking forward to like crunchy PB&J sandwiches, maybe throwing, I know this sounds, Ryan got me hooked on it, throwing some potato chips into a PB&J. I know that sounds like chaotic.
What flavor potato? Just like plain Lay's.
Know me. I'm a plain Lay's. Yeah. Plain Lay's. Yeah,
those are the best.
Get out of here with barbecue or something else, you know? Yeah.
What kind of jelly? Simple. Like what flavor jelly? Are you like a strawberry jelly or grape jelly?
No, so a fancy jelly. We have like friends that have a farm and they like have all these preserves that we get. So I have like so many to pick from. Like pomegranates, like a passion fruit mix one. They're just amazing.
So bougie good. You are, so, John. Yes.
Yeah. Bougie with chips. Bougie with potato chips.
I make my own jam, so I have like homemade raspberry jam that we've been using all year round. And it's really good. That's my favorite.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a blast.
I'm going to have the Smuckers. Wait. So you guys, just whatever.
What about that stuff that was like, it was both? And it was in like one bottle. It was the peanut butter and the jelly from back in the day.
Oh my gosh.
What was it called? Goober grape is what it was called. Yeah.
There we go. So good.
Oh, it's going to be great. So anyways, stay tuned for Single Track 6. This is going to be awesome. I've literally, I signed up for this race in 2019. And it's, you know, because of COVID and then because of me having a baby and the event being amazing, they deferred my registry or my registration to this year. We're super stoked to do it. I cannot wait. It's going to be fun to bring you all along for the ride and for all of you to get live through us and see, you know, through the adventures and misadventures, what we have going on throughout the race. It's going to be a blast. So Ivy, you've got a new bike for this too. Well, yeah. We're going to cover that in the preview podcast. Don't say a thing. We'll keep them in suspense. So stay tuned for that. And don't look at Ivy's Instagram where you can totally see that new bike. So send your questions to trainerroad.com/podcast. Go sign up for Trainer Road. That's how we can make more features. That's how we can do all this stuff. It's hugely helpful. Go check out Alex's Instagram, Alex Larson. You can find her on there. She puts out awesome content. It's hilarious and super relatable and fun and educational. So go check that out. If you want to have a dietitian help you through your training, Alex, I think is taking clients unless we're totally overloading her team.
No, we still have openings because we're always like graduating clients and bringing on new ones. So we're just like rotating, but yeah, I have a team of myself and then two other fabulous dietitians. And we love all of the Trainer Road cyclists that we've been bringing out. They are just the best and they're so loyal to Trainer Road that I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to have this baby and then recover and then I can get on my bike and check out Trainer Road because I just hear so many great things about it.
That's awesome. So, well, thank you, Alex. Stoked to have you on here and we will talk to everybody next week with the Single Track 6 preview. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.